Good morning, everyone. I'm Jennifer Carr, Vice Chair of the Advisory Planning Commission, and I'm going to call this meeting to order at 9:32. The date is Wednesday, July 14th, and we are here in our virtual webinar. For the first item on the agenda is roll call to determine a quorum. Tracy?
Mr. Olling?
Present.
Mr. Booth?
Present.
Ms. Carr?
Present.
Ms. Chandler?
Present.
Mr. Drake?
Present.
Ms. Ferris?
Here.
Mr. Gavon? Mr. Hill? Ms. Jacobson?
Here.
Mr. Letton?
I'm here.
Ms. Roverud? Ms. Simon? Ms. Stala? Mr. Teixeira?
Morning.
Mr. Smokey? Mr. Young?
Morning.
Tracy, I apologize. This is Hillary Roverud. I'm here.
Oh, thank you. Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. So now, as we have been doing, I will go over the rules for the meeting for the day. To observe the meeting, go to trpa.gov under the calendar header. Click on Advisory Planning Commission Meeting. Online meeting for July 14th, 2021. There you will find a link to the public webinar hosted on GoToWebinar. To address APC members directly with your comments, please utilize the hand-raising function in the control panel of the GoToWebinar, which you should see under the red microphone. At the appropriate time for public comments, please raise your hand by clicking on the hand icon, and a TRPA staff member will unmute you and indicate that you can begin your public comment. Please state your name at the beginning of your comment. If you have requested a reasonable accommodation from TRPA and have been provided a unique PIN for dial-in, you will be unmuted at that time you requested to make your public comment. If you're using GoToWebinar's Instant Join web app, please make sure that it is opened in the Google Chrome browser and that you allow access to your microphone in order to be unmuted. Finally, if you have called into the general attendee line with the access code posted on the website, please be aware that you are in listen-only mode. For APC members, if you wish to speak, you can alert me via the chat function or speak up when someone else isn't speaking. I will monitor the chat function to try to keep things running smoothly. APC members may only use the chat function to indicate their desire to speak. This function must not be used to have sidebar conversation in order for us to prevent violations of the open meeting law. Everyone, please remember to mute your mic unless you're speaking to cut down on background noise.
Okay.
It looks like we have a change for this meeting this week. So I would ask that all members turn on their cameras as we now have sufficient capacity on our platform to accommodate everyone, which would be nice to see everybody. All right, moving on to approval of the agenda. Are there any changes to the agenda?
Madam Chair, there are no changes to the agenda.
Thank you. I will deem the agenda approved as posted for the record. All right, moving on to item number three, public interest comments. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission, please use the hand-raising function now, and you will be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. All public comments should be as brief and concise as possible so that all who wish to participate may do so. Testimony should not be repeated. The chair shall have the discretion to set appropriate time allotments for individual speakers. We start that at 3 minutes for individuals and group representatives. No time for participants will be permitted, and you can't cede your time to others. Written comments received prior to the meeting were forwarded to the APC members, and in the interest of efficient meeting management, we may limit the duration of public comments to a total of 1 hour, depending on how this goes. Any unheard comments can be submitted via email to tcampbell@trpa.gov if we get that far, and will be forwarded to all members. Please note that APC is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised during the public comment period that are not listed on the agenda. So I'll now turn this over to staff to manage the public comment period.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more time for members of the public. If you'd like to make a comment at this time, please click on the hand raising button, which is on the left-hand side of your GoToWebinar control panel. We have one hand raised. Chase Janbrin, you are unmuted on my end. You unmute on yours, you can address the APC.
Hi, good morning. Is this the appropriate time to make a comment regarding ADUs? Okay, I'll hold my comment for that agenda item. Thank you.
Yes, we will have public comment available on each of the agenda items as we go through the day.
Madam Chair, we have no other hands raised to make a comment at this time.
All right, thank you very much. And we will close the first public comment period. So now on to disposition of the minutes. We are on agenda item number 4, and we have a set of minutes from June 9th, 2021 on page 7 of your packets. Are there any questions or comments from APC members? All right, hearing none, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes from the June meeting.
So moved. This is Ellery Stoller.
Thank you, Ellery. Do I have a second?
Second, this is Judy Simon.
Thank you, Judy. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any abstentions? Aye. All right. Then the motion passes. Right. We will move on to agenda item number 5, the public hearing regarding the code amendments to the TRPA Code of Ordinances. The item 5A is phase 1 housing code amendments to the code of ordinances related to bonus unit boundaries, including amendments to chapter 52, non-conforming density changes, including amendments to chapter 31, accessory dwelling unit changes, including amendments to chapters 21, 31, 39, 50, 51, 52, and 90, as well as Myers, Tahoe Valley and Tourist Core area plans, and the Rules of Procedure, Section 12. These changes also pertain to Development Rights Strategic Initiative Code change cleanup, potential residential uses of bonus unit pools, including amendments to Chapters 51 and 52. And the resolution can be found on page 23 of your packet. I know that was a lot, but we're going to get a presentation from Karen Fink to lead us through all of what we have to consider for us today. So go ahead, Karen.
Thank you, Jennifer. Good morning, members of the APC chair, Karen Fink with TRPA's housing program. So Tracy, if you could advance the slide, please. We're back today with the a request for your recommendation for approval of the phase one housing amendments to the governing board and a recommendation for approval of the findings as well. So this follows up on the presentation that we made last month, which was an informational hearing. And we're now going to bring forward the final proposal, highlight a few things that have changed since we presented last month, and just go into a little bit of the detail on some of the questions that APC members raised. So these amendments have emerged out of extensive consultation with the Tahoe Living Housing and Community Revitalization Working Group, which is a committee of this commission. And the amendments are really focused on addressing the serious housing shortage that we're facing in the basin today. So I'm not sure, I can't, not seeing the slides, but I'll keep going and probably Tracy will be able to get them going soon. So we went over, so we went over these in quite a bit of detail last time. Actually, Tracy, can you just go back one slide? Thank you. So we did go over these quite a bit of detail last time. Thanks, that's the slide. So I'm just going to remind everybody at a high level what the concrete elements of the proposal is. So next slide, please. So as we mentioned last time, this proposal to encourage and allow more workforce housing types is fully within the development pattern identified in the regional plan and the 2020 regional transportation plan that was just approved, and it's fully within our growth caps. So the impacts of that growth have already been analyzed, and this proposal moves forward policy changes that further implement the goals of the regional plan, such as encouraging growth in walkable neighborhoods and centers, providing sufficient workforce housing to help meet local and regional housing targets, and providing housing that's sized appropriately for local workers and residents. Next slide, please. So at the previous APC meeting, we talked a little bit about how these amendments align with some of the missing middle concepts that we've presented about before. And we also noted that we've identified that some of our code really actually ends up encouraging homes that are as large as 4,500 square feet. We also took another look into our data and looked at what the size of homes were that were built in the early 1970s compared to the size of homes that are being built in the basin in more recent years. So in the five-year snapshot between 1971 and 1975, the median home size was 780 square feet, whereas the median home size of homes built in the most recent 5 years is nearly 2,000 square feet. And that's not to say that some families don't need larger size homes, but our needs assessment studies have shown that the vast majority of homes that are needed are sized between studio units to two-bedroom units. Next slide, please. So as part of addressing this overall issue to try to increase the amount and diversity of housing options and meet other regional plan goals, we've developed these phase one housing amendments, which include three major components. So I'm going to go over those now in just slightly less detail than I did last time. So the first element is to expand the bonus unit boundary to encompass previous planning efforts. So the first planning effort is the 2018 Development Rights Strategic Initiative, which established a 1/2 mile buffer of transit as the area where we want to encourage the use of bonus units. And bonus units are where you can receive a bonus unit, a development right for free in exchange for deed restricting that unit to affordable, moderate, or achievable housing. And then next slide, please. Another planning effort was the 2012 regional plan, which identified town centers as areas where we want to focus and direct development. And then next slide, please. We also want to make sure that bonus unit boundary encourages multifamily zones, which is where historically we've had a lot of affordable housing and a lot of our workforce housing is today. So this next slide, please. This expanded the bonus unit boundary just slightly by about 15%. And a question came up last time as to why there's a little bit of area jutting out into the Tahoe Keys. It's actually covered by the word South Lake Tahoe right now. But that is Olawai Street, where there's quite a bit of condominium development. And so just as an example of how this code change would work, in that area, if somebody wanted to deed restrict one of those existing condominiums for affordable, moderate, or achievable development, they could get a bonus unit for that. Or if someone wanted to redevelop one of those developments into affordable housing and receive bonus units, they could do that. So next slide, please. So in the environmental analysis, we compared the new area of the bonus unit boundary, and that's what you see in orange, to areas of the basin where our modeling shows that we have trip lengths that are below or equal to our average trip length. So trip lengths correlates closely to vehicle miles traveled. And when we encourage more development in areas where trip lengths are below the average, that helps us bring the overall average down. So you can see from the map, and maybe some of you were able to look at the link that we provided in the environmental document online, these areas, these new areas of the proposed bonus unit boundary correspond very closely to those traffic analysis zones where we have lower trip lengths. So next slide, please. So the next change is to allow non-conforming tourist density to be used as residential density on site, as long as multi-residential is an allowed use in that location. So next slide, please. And so here, the next two slides show an example of the change compared to what's currently allowed. So under our current code, if a motel property owner wants to redevelop, if they redevelop to, and they have, if they have existing tourist units that are over the allowed tourist densities or over the allowable residential densities, if they redevelop to new tourist units, they can keep all of those units on site. However, if they redevelop to residential, they have to conform with the existing residential densities, which are much lower. So they would be able to build many fewer units on site. And then next slide, please. With the proposed code, they would be able to keep all of those units as residential units on site. So a question came up offline that I thought others might have the same question. And the question was, does this create more residential development? Because you saw in the first slide that only 6 residential units would be allowed, whereas in what wonder what we're proposing, 17 residential units would be allowed in this example. But this does not create additional residential development, and I want to explain why. So under our existing code, tourist units can convert to multifamily development rights at a ratio of 1 to 1.5 units. And that conversion ratio was developed during our development rights strategic initiative in 2018. So that initiative put forward environmentally neutral conversion ratios for different types of development rights. So under the existing code, the owner of this property with 17 tourist units could convert these 17 units to 25 multifamily development rights, basically. But under the existing code, they would only be able to build 6 of those units on site, and they would have to bank and transfer off the remaining 19 units. But under this proposal, they would still get the same 25 multifamily residential units of use, but they would be able to keep 17 of them on site, and they would transfer off the rest. So next slide, please. So the environmental analysis for this was really already completed under the Development Rights Strategic Initiative, which developed those environmentally neutral conversion ratios. So that initiative already specified that converting tourist units to multifamily is environmentally neutral at those ratios. And this would basically allow, it wouldn't even use the entire amount of multifamily development that results from the conversion on site. It would just be one-to-one development. But in addition to that, we did want to take a look and just see where existing tourist development is to determine if this code change would, you know, really be encouraging development in the places where we want to see more compact development and transit supportive densities. And again, from the maps that hopefully some of you were able to look at online, all of the existing tourist density that would be eligible for this change is within the proposed bonus unit boundary. So this is the South Shore area. And then, Tracy, if you could go to the next slide. This just shows the North Shore. So for the next, okay, next slide, please. So the third major element of this proposal is to allow more flexibility for accessory dwelling units, also known as ADUs, and to really do more to encourage this workforce housing type. So next slide, please. So as you're aware, our existing code does not allow accessory dwelling units on parcels of less than 1 acre in size. So this proposal would lift that size limit, that parcel size limit on residential property or parcels. Where the ADUs would now be allowed, we would allow up to two ADUs per parcel. This would allow one attached ADU or repurposed existing space and one detached ADU. And then in keeping with a goal of trying to reduce permitting hurdles for workforce housing, we are proposing that the noticing requirements for accessory dwelling units would be the same as for other single family uses and expansions of single family uses. So we want to try to remove permitting hurdles so that workforce housing doesn't have to do, you know, go through additional requirements that other uses don't need to do. Next slide, please. So that those are the TRPA recommendations, but local ADU regulations would also apply. So that means that in Douglas County and Washoe County, those two counties have codified a 1 acre parcel limit restriction in their own codes in the Tahoe, for the Tahoe Basin. So the ADUs would not be allowed on parcels of less than 1 acre with this proposal. The city of South Lake Tahoe, El Dorado County, and Placer County have already approved their own code changes or are in the process of approving code changes that allow accessory dwelling units on all residential parcels. So they would be allowed in those three jurisdictions. However, they do not allow rentals of less than 30 days. And as far as the area plans are concerned, Placer County, in their recent area plan amendment, they already incorporated the needed language to allow for accessory dwelling units on all residential parcels. And this packet includes the needed changes to the Myers area plan and the two South Lake Tahoe area plans. So next slide, please. So for the accessory dwelling unit element of this proposal, we went ahead and looked at this in our transportation model. So we wanted to model some scenarios of how this could play out. We do expect to see that most accessory dwelling units will be built within the bonus unit boundary, because that's where that's where all of the incentives lie to encourage accessory dwelling units and to encourage them to be deed restricted for local workforce housing. So accessory dwelling units built within the bonus unit boundary get their application fee waived. They will most likely have lower mobility mitigation fees in most places. And they also don't need to go out on the market and buy a development right, which can be very expensive. However, the proposal does allow accessory dwelling units to be built outside of the bonus unit boundary with a full development right. And that's consistent with encouraging our goal of encouraging as many of our remaining development rights to be used for smaller workforce units. So we did want to analyze a scenario that took into account kind of the furthest extent of where we might expect to see development and analyze what happens if we start, you know, seeing development in areas where we previously hadn't anticipated seeing more than one unit per parcel. So our TRPA modeling team analyzed a scenario where we assumed that a significant number of our remaining development rights would be built as accessory dwelling units. And we assumed that all of these ADUs would be built in areas that are zoned single family only. At the same time, we also have updated information about affordable housing projects that are in the pipeline, such as Sugar Pine Village and the Pioneer Ski Run project. So we included that in our modeling as well. So even though this scenario shifted more homes into areas where there are longer trip lengths, this was offset by an increase in lower income households, which have lower trip rates overall. And that's because we're seeing more implementation of our bonus unit incentive program as we expected and anticipated. So that overall modeling effort showed that we were still consistent with the VMT threshold. Also, because the remaining development rights are really a pretty small portion of our overall build out, and this particular shift represented only 1% of our total build out, that's really a pretty small shift, and the impacts of those shifts are really absorbed by other measures that we put in place in our regional transportation plan and the regional plan. So we are confident that this is consistent with our VMT threshold. So next slide, please. A couple of questions came up at the APC hearing, so we just wanted to touch on those briefly here. One was, would the ADU proposal disincentivize transfers of coverage off of sensitive lands onto higher capability lands. And we, in the environmental analysis, we showed that this really does not lead to that outcome. So this proposal does not change our coverage regulations at all. The TRP code has three different incentive programs in place to incentivize transfer of coverage out of sensitive lands into non-sensitive areas, and those also remain in place and have been utilized recently. Finally, we are really finding that the recent applications that are coming in for single family homes, those homes are fully maxing out their coverage in nearly all cases. So adding the option of doing an ADU doesn't really add another incentive to maximize your coverage that people aren't already using. So it really just provides an option to provide an additional workforce housing with that coverage. We also had a request, you know, to make sure to delve into the traffic, parking, and VMT analysis in the IEC, and also, you know, question about evacuation. So these are really key elements of the environmental analysis. And the overall development, as I mentioned, the actual amount of development was fully analyzed in the 2012 regional plan, and this proposal doesn't change that overall amount of growth. And the proposal itself is consistent with promoting the types of development that reduce overall trips, reduce household vehicle ownership, and locate people along major transportation and evacuation corridors. So we did not find that there were significant environmental impacts from these proposed amendments. And then finally, a question came up at the regional plan implementation committee and local government housing committee meetings about really making sure that these bonus units are being used as intended for local residents. And so we did, based on those comments, we made a couple of small changes to the actual code proposal itself that you saw in your packet. And that was to add some language to the affordable housing definition in Chapter 90 of TRPA's code to add that affordable housing is intended for permanent residents or seasonal workers. And then we also clarified some of the compliance language that's part of the bonus unit incentive program. So next slide, please. So the next steps for this amendment that after the hearing today, later this month, we'll take the proposal to the Regional Plan Implementation Committee for a recommendation for approval to the Governing Board. And then we will be asking the Governing Board for an approval on the same day. And then starting in September, we'll be convening the Tahoe Living Working Group again to start looking at further incentives for accessory dwelling units, because we've heard from many of the working group members that we likely need more incentives to really see accessory dwelling units used as work, you know, to providing workforce housing as we, within the numbers that we anticipate. And then we'll also start looking at some site constraints that disproportionately affect workforce housing. And for those of you Star Wars fans, we watch Star Wars sometimes at our house, and I noticed that the Ewoks seem to have built an accessory dwelling unit up here in this tree. So this is not, we're not the first ones to come up with this idea. So next slide, please. So thank you very much for listening to the presentation, and I'm happy to take any questions or go into more detail on anything.
Thank you very much, Karen. I appreciate the presentation. I also appreciate you addressing the questions that came up at the last APC meeting in the interim since this packet came out, and doing a good job of documenting, in my mind, the parking question that I had at the last meeting. So now we will go to questions or comments from APC members. If you'd like to speak, you can indicate that in the chat function, or which there is no one yet, or you can speak up if no one else is speaking. So I'll open the floor.
Hi, Jennifer. This is Eric. May I speak?
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask Karen to maybe expand a little bit on the idea of the tourist accommodation units being converted to residential units. I think it's important not to miss my understanding that if you convert those residential units and get three bonus units, three units from TRPA for committing those units to being affordable, then you have your regular units that then you can go sell on the marketplace. I think in some instances that will help some people make a deal actually work. And I was going to ask Karen to make sure or to tell me if I'm wrong or to talk about that little incentive part that I think exists for developers when they get free units from TRPA.
Yes, that's correct. So if someone wants to convert their hotel to basically they can take those tourist units, as Eric mentioned, they can convert them to full multifamily development rights. Those are market rate development rights. But if they want to deed restrict, if they want to build those units as deed restricted units for affordability, they can get bonus units for the development rights. Then they still have those 25, if it was the 17 unit development that we showed in the example, they would still have those 25 multifamily development rights that they could go out and sell on the market. So that would be an additional, a sort of additional revenue to help fund their project.
Thank you, Karen. I think that's kind of an important point. It's one of the ways that it might make it possible for people to actually consider doing this conversion.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Steve, and then I have Hillary in the chat after Steve.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, fellow APC members. I wanted to call attention to the email that we received from our colleague, Jason Drew, who isn't able to be with us today, but pointing out again, underscoring the concern that I know a number of us had about creating more housing while having minimal impact on coverage and other environmental thresholds. And talks about, you know, whether for ADUs a full development right is necessary. So I know Karen is keenly aware of the issue. We've discussed it as a group and individually with staff. I just wanted to highlight Jason's email, which came to us this morning.
Thank you, Steve. Karen, are you familiar with Jason's email that came to us this morning? And can you address existing structure ADUs?
Yeah, I did see the email, and this was something that came up at the working group as one of a very strong recommendation from one working group member in particular, but several other working group members also noted their support that since ADUs are generally very small, and particularly in the case of junior ADUs, they don't expand the footprint of the home, that perhaps we could look at a way that they don't use up a whole bonus unit. Or development right, because that development right could be used for any size of home. So it seems that this is actually serving as a bit of a disincentive to use development rights for small homes, because you know the property owner could get a much higher return from building a larger house. So that is definitely something that we flagged and we'll be looking at in the next phase.
Thank you, Karen. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you. Go ahead, Hillary.
Thank you, Chair Carr, and thank you, Karen, for the revisions that you made and the proposal related to my comments at our last meeting. Really appreciate you working with me on that. So Jason Drew's question, you know, I also concur that that's something that we need to continue discussion on because I think we do see a discrepancy between the same level of development right being required for a 15-bedroom home as a garage conversion, for example. So I think that that is something that if we could keep that on the working group's radar and perhaps bring that back for discussion with APC as well, that would be helpful. But I do think this is a really good step forward, step in the right direction. We also got a comment from Kathy Julian. She was asking questions about, well, her concern was a scenario where in, you know, Washoe County, they don't have the same restriction on accessory dwelling units that California requires to prevent them from being short-term rentals. And thank you for showing kind of the differences in the current regulations in your PowerPoint, but can you speak to kind of this scenario that she's laid out in her email and how that relates to the neighborhood compatibility requirements with residential allocations? And the question that comes to my mind, is there any correlation between the neighborhood compatibility requirements and issuance of bonus units?
So neighborhood compatibility requirements are really related to the issuance of annual allocations. There aren't restrictions. There's not really a correlation with issuance of bonus units at this time. But, you know, in order to allow accessory dwelling units on all residential parcels in Washoe or Douglas County, that would take a full area plan amendment, which would need to go through, you know, the entire process that we've just gone through here. So it would need to come for informational hearings to the APC and the Regional Plan Implementation Committee, and then come forward for approvals, because it is also a TRPA document. It's not just a Washoe County or Douglas County document. So there would be additional public hearings on those changes. And then I did also want to note that Washoe County and Douglas County, throughout the entire county, they have parcel restrictions that on ADUs. And so I believe in Washoe County, they are restricted to parcels of greater than a third of an acre. And in Douglas County, I think it's greater than half an acre. So there are countywide restrictions. So I would think that there need to be further discussion about what's the appropriate level for the Tahoe area and how does that align with the rest of the code in those counties.
And when a bonus unit is issued, is there a deed restriction that requires it to be a permanent resident?
And
that,
yes.
So if it's a ADU that was constructed as a result of a bonus unit, then that would not be allowed to go into a short-term rental, regardless of what the counties may change in their regulations. Is that accurate?
Yes, correct. Thanks for bringing that up. The bonus units come with a restriction that they cannot be used for short-term rentals.
Okay. And then the market rate ones are tied to the neighborhood compatibility with allocations, if that's where they're getting their development rights.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. Just wanted to make sure that we kind of address that comment.
Other questions from APC members? All right. Hearing none at the moment, we will now move to public comment on this item. So again, to participate in the meeting, go to trpa.gov in the calendar and click on the Advisory Planning Commission meeting, July 14th, 2021. There you will find a link to the public webinar hosted on GoToWebinar. If any member of the public wishes to address the APC, please use the hand-raising function now, and you will be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. So go ahead, staff, and take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First hand up is Chase Janvrin. Chase, you're unmuted on my end to address the APC.
Great. Thank you very much. And good morning, APC Commission members. I'm Chase Janvrin, Program Manager for the Tahoe Prosperity Center, and an active member of the TRPA's housing work group. I want to start by thanking you and the TRPA staff for staying so focused on addressing the housing crisis in the basin. And there've been some great progress out of the work group that I want to acknowledge first. I think allowing tourist density to grandfather into residential density should allow developers to pencil these hotel motel conversions. We have so many old and dilapidated hotels and motels that are already serving as de facto affordable housing because we have such limited housing stock. So I hope this spurs a new wave of redevelopment in the coming years. However, these types of projects are probably years away. So that said, I don't think we've done enough to incentivize ADUs, which is one of the easiest, cheapest, and fastest types of housing that could be provided. Expanding the bonus units boundaries is a step in the right direction for the city of Southlake, but it doesn't go far enough for residents of Myers as it omits most of the area due to a lack of transit. But the biggest issue is with development rights. Requiring a full development right to permit an ADU serves as a deterrent to affordable by design development. and I understand that coverage is a core tenet of the TRPA. So when the existing footprint of an already constructed home can include an ADU, why should a development right be required? Attached ADUs, junior ADUs, and existing construction shouldn't require a second development right, period. I've submitted a couple of pictures of examples of where this could apply. I don't know if you have those and can see them. But there's a critical need for workforce housing here. I think we all agree on that. And it's truly become a crisis. We need to find ways to allow new, affordable by design housing as quickly as possible so the local workforce can afford to stay here. Simply allowing already constructed space to become legal ADUs is the fastest path to increasing housing that has no impact on coverage, requires no government subsidies, allows our community to participate in the solution, and the net result is simply increased density, which is exactly what the other recommendations are already incentivizing. We should be doing all that we can to not just allow, but to incentivize affordable by design housing and not depend solely on affordable by government subsidy housing. As one of the regional conveners on housing in Lake Tahoe, the Tahoe Prosperity Center strongly supports the recommendations made by TRPA staff, but we encourage an amendment to allow for ADUs in already constructed space to not require development rights. Thank you for your time today and keep up the great work.
Next hand raised is Gavin Feiger. Gavin, you're unmuted on my end. If you unmute on yours, you can address the APC.
Hey, good morning. It's Gavin Feiger speaking on behalf of the League to Save Lake Tahoe. Thanks APC chair and members and TRPA staff for taking the time to consider ADUs today and for the opportunity to provide comments. As you know, the League is dedicated to protecting and restoring the environmental health, sustainability, and scenic beauty of the Tahoe Basin. And in connection with our mission, we advocate for the implementation of sound, environmentally friendly policies contained within regional land use and planning documents. So ADUs fit squarely into our mission here. We've been the only environmental group actively and continuously participating in this housing working group and the efforts leading up to its formation over the last few years. And it's been great working with all the stakeholders, TRPA staff, especially Karen and Alyssa, and our feedback and input has been heard. Our concerns have been the same since the start: coverage, density, and transportation impacts, which directly and indirectly impact the lake's natural environment. So addressing housing issues at the lake are a top priority for us and for many partners, but any effort to improve housing must also ensure that we're protecting the environment. We really applaud the process and support the ADU incentive package as presented today. We see the potential for ADUs to help achieve housing and transportation goals, but we really need data showing that they're an effective tool. The effectiveness of ADUs in reaching our housing and transportation goals needs to be assessed for considering more incentives, especially those involving coverage and development rights. Coverage requirements and development rights are critical to addressing Lake Clarity decline, which does continue to decline. Development rights are, development rights came out in 1987 to cap the total amount of development potential and ensure that development aligns with environmental capacity. So, we feel pretty comfortable that, where we are with development rights. We are interested in looking, we see the disparity between a large mansion and a studio apartment. We're interested in looking at it, but, in the longer term. Coverage really gives us the most headache. We'd prefer the TRPA look at using its authority to reduce or eliminate parking minimums, to reduce the coverage needed, and to reduce transportation impacts instead of allowing more coverage. So let's try to figure out, what we're using coverage for, see if that's the best use of it. Are we trying to, create coverage for people or create coverage for cars, right? Today we'd like you to recommend approval of the ADU package included in the staff report, but going forward, any further actions, especially those affecting coverage and development rights, are longer term actions that may have significant environmental impacts and need to be carefully considered based on data, monitoring, surveys, anything that can be done with the new ADUs that are going to be built with this new package. So we look forward to continuing working with the working group and TRPA staff and the APC to increase affordable and workforce housing while minimizing environmental impacts. Thanks for your time.
And the final hand raised today is Patrick Taylor. Patrick, you are unmuted on staff end. If you unmute yourself, you can address the APC.
Good morning, APC. This is Patrick Taylor with Alpine Corporation. Thank you, Karen, for your great presentation, and all of the board and board members, and Jennifer, for allowing me to speak this morning on this issue. I think it's a very important issue, and as one of the few workforce housing developers that are based in Lake Tahoe, really keep my hand on the pulse of what's going on here. We currently have three projects in the basin and continue to work on more projects. And I firmly believe in what Chase has just said in regards to the ADU issue. I think we also have some other issues in regards to what is being presented to you today, I think, is great. But I think there's some things that have been being missed right now in the housing overall for workforce housing. We have these large companies such as Related coming in and getting these projects. And these people aren't from our area. And they're coming to these government entities and they're taking the money from our local government entities, which are from our local taxpayers. They're taking it away to Related as examples based out of New York City. Stephen Ross is a billionaire. I had this conversation with the Mountain Housing Council last week when I asked him, why aren't you guys doing achievable housing? Oh, well, there's not high enough returns. I said, well, Stephen Ross is a billionaire. Why doesn't he stick his hand in his pocket and pull some of his billions of dollars out? They didn't have an answer. I could put my hand in my pocket. And I'm not a billionaire. I can fund my achievable housing projects. Why can't he? Same thing with Caleb Root, who's half and half with Related on the Dollar Creek project. Owns 14,000 units. I don't own 14,000 units. It's the same thing. And then they're building those out of modular, which is Caleb Root's factory in Idaho. So we're losing jobs, we're losing local tax money. It's being given away to these companies that are taking that money out of the basin and going somewhere else. So I think we really need to be cognizant of the fact that's what's going on here. So that's something that needs to be really looked at. And then I want to also address what the gentleman from the league just talked about in regards to coverage. If you look at that Sugar Pine Village project, look at the parking. I've adjusted with Mia Kang on her community outreach. You have these giant parking lots with nothing over them. And I asked her, why don't you have any covered parking or carports, which the whole thing is a waste of coverage? And her answer was, oh, well, the snow plows will hit it. Well, that's baloney. And second and most importantly, why don't they build the buildings over the parking? It's simple. Well, they're not doing it because, again, they want to save money. But that money goes into their pocket. So, again, we need to be real conscious of this stuff. Every project that we design, because we're conscious of coverage, we build garages on the bottom floor and we stay within TRPA's height restrictions. So we spend more money with our architects to make sure that they stay within those TRPA height restrictions. Yes, it costs more money, but we put out a better project.
Pardon me, Mr. Taylor, could you wrap it up for us? Thank you.
That's all I have to say. Thank you for your time. And thanks, Karen, for all of your hard work.
Thank you. And if you have additional thoughts, please feel free to submit them to the TRPA by email, and they will be distributed to the APC members as well. Are there any additional public comments at this time?
No, Madam Chair, there are no other hands raised to comment on this item.
Thank you very much. All right, I will turn it back to the APC members. Are there any other comments or questions that come to mind before we move on? Go ahead, Steve.
Thank you. I just wanted to reinforce one of Mr. Janvrin's statements. I think we all
captured it, but it really is that we should do all we can, not just to allow, but incentivize affordable by design housing and not just to depend solely on affordable by government subsidy. I think that's really critical. And, you know, I know there are interested developers here. One of the commodities that we have are the older motels. And we've at the Tao Chamber just recently been contacted by a firm that specializes in doing that. So I think the issue of making sure that if the conversion occurs from, you know, motels to residential, that we don't lose a lot of the units. So I'm pleased to see that addressed. And I know that that person, that company that contacted us has also been in touch with folks at the City of South Lake Tahoe. So there's some good opportunities here to do some housing by design and to also allow some other opportunities for us to get housing without necessarily always having to be subsidized or to be created as new coverage. Thank you.
Chair Carr, I had a couple of other comments.
Go ahead, Hillary.
I wanted to address the comments related to parking for ADUs. And I just wanted to note that for the city's ADU ordinance, and I'm assuming El Dorado and Placer may have similar provisions, I'm not familiar with Nevada and Douglas, but for the city's regulations for ADUs, we do have a provision that allows an ADU to be developed without any parking if it is within a half mile of walking distance of public transit. And so I would kind of want to make sure that as part of the conversation about parking and its effect on coverage and things like that, that there is also a focus on public transit. You know, I really think that the TRPA regulations that are currently before us, changing the criteria for the bonus unit locations, the city, I think most jurisdictions have embraced this idea that if you're putting development near transit, then it makes sense to reduce the parking requirement. And, I just wanted to note that that's already, those changes are already being made. And the real concern is with public transit. If you're going to provide development without parking, then you've got to provide some opportunity for people that live or work there to be able to get around. And I just don't want to lose, I don't want the focus to be on the parking requirements because I think we're already making a lot of progress in that area. But we aren't going to be able to probably go far enough until we really address our public transit needs in the basin. And that would also, I think, relate to the comment about, you know, Myers and the public transit service for the Myers community. And, you know, if there isn't public transit there, then they don't have a whole lot of options other than vehicles. So that's an area that I think we really need to work on in conjunction with the parking requirements.
Thank you, Hillary. Are there other comments or questions from the APC before we move to motions? I have one question that stems from the photos that Mr. Janrin provided, which were very helpful. So my thanks to him for sending those to us. If there are existing like mother-in-law's quarters or, an additional garage or something that someone wanted to convert to a rental unit, what would actually prevent them from doing that? Would they get caught up in a net if they needed to get like a building permit for adding plumbing or, what stops people from just creating these ADUs now? I mean, or, you know, at any time in the future?
Well, from TRPA's perspective, if they want to add a kitchen to that unit, that's what triggers our requirement for a development right. So, I mean, if they don't want to add a kitchen, you know, lots of people just rent out an extra room in their house, then that's fine. But once you want to add a kitchen and really make it an independent living unit, that's when some of our requirements kick in.
Okay, thank you.
And I could just add a little to that, just from our experience. You know, the city has had a program in place for many years where if we find garages that have been converted illegally, they do have the opportunity to legalize those, but they do have to address building code requirements, because often when we find the illegal conversions, they have safety and sanitary issues with them. But we do have a program that was in place in partnership with TRPA to be able to allow those to be legalized through the bonus unit program. But they do have to get building permits and come up to code requirements.
Thanks, that's helpful. All right, Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
One question. Maybe Karen, I was intrigued by Chase's comment from the Tao Prosperity Center about the possibility of ADUs being able to be built without a development right. Can you explain what the implications of that would be? There's some obvious, probably streamlining benefits in getting it done, but I know it's a bigger conversation, but what would the implications of being able to build ADUs without development rights be?
Do you mean positive and potential environmental impacts, or?
Well, obviously it would be more expeditious, it would be cheaper, but what else would it help with?
I do think Chase is pointing out, and we've even observed this. So we have received 5 applications for ADUs from people in Placer County, where it's been allowed for several years. So that gives us a little bit of explanation or sort of experience on how these permits are going. Under Placer County's current code, those all need to be deed restricted. So it is interesting that it's pretty straightforward. The applicants, are happy to, they seem fine with the deed restriction, but it does add quite a bit of time. They need to pay for that deed restriction, they need to get it recorded. It adds time to the process. So I guess, one thought is, again, in keeping with removing barriers, are there ways to streamline that, to make it simpler? I mean, I think there's a variety of things that we would need to look at. We definitely, this would need a separate environmental analysis to determine if there are environmental impacts that we need to consider. We currently, our model, the modeling that we use, just and a lot of our conversion ratios does kind of treat one unit as a certain impact. It doesn't take into account the size of that unit. So I think that's where we might want to start honing our tools a little bit to get some additional data on how units of different sizes actually impact the environment, so that we could make policies that more, that more closely align with the environmental impacts due to size. So I think that's what we would need to start looking at to better evaluate Chase's suggestion.
Okay, thank you. I got my wheels turning. I appreciate the facts.
Can I make a comment? Sue Chandler speaking. I don't think I've received anything that might have come in today. You've been referring to pictures, you've been referring to comments, but I haven't seen anything new come in today besides what's online. I just wanted you to know that, because it's hard for us to make comments if we don't see what comes in. Thank you.
We can make sure to forward that comment letter to you, Susan.
Can I just ask a procedural question? Mm-hmm. If we wanted to consider the 4 motions that are before us individually, and then perhaps add a 5th for the APC to discuss whether we want to relay on to the governing board any recommendations with respect to future consideration of modifying the development right requirements for ADUs. Would that be appropriate, or would it make more sense to do that as part of one of these 4 motions?
I have input from TRPA Legal. Ms. Marsh, possibly, or John, Esther?
This is John, Esther. Can you hear me?
You're kind of choppy.
Okay. I think if you're watching asking that, we expedite the look at the development rights. I think that would be very appropriate. And I think if it wasn't clear for Karen's discussion, and I think many of you serve on that working group, know that that's an item that's on the agenda to come up anyway, but it doesn't hurt to reinforce it with an additional motion. Hope you could hear that.
Yes, I think we heard enough to make that clear.
Hello.
Is that Ms. Marsh?
I'm sorry,
Ms. Marsh, you're breaking up.
Sorry, I was having trouble unmuting. But John, I'm sorry, I'm having some technical problems here.
We can hear you now.
Oh, you can. Okay, good. So I'm sorry, I didn't hear exactly what John Hester said.
I'll repeat it, Marcia. What I said was, if the APC would like to add a fifth motion like Hillary suggested, asking that the staff look at change in the bonus unit requirements for ADUs, I think that would be fine, because that's, as many of the members of the APC know who work on the working group, that's already on the agenda to be looked at in the near future. And I think just reinforcing that desire would be beneficial for the governing board to know that.
Yes.
So I think it's totally appropriate if they want to add a fifth motion to do that.
I agree, and I do think it should be a separate motion from the motions surrounding the recommendation on this item.
Great, thank you very much. So, Hillary, we will handle that as a fifth motion, so you've got some time to draft it. And Ms. Chandler, I did pull up the email that contained Mr. Jenrin's comments, and it looks like you were inadvertently omitted from the list. And so we will ensure that that comment letter gets over to you, as well as any other comments that were received for the meeting.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, APC members, are we ready to entertain a motion? Do we have the first one on a slide for us, please? That's always makes it easier.
I could just, Madam Chair, I could read it off the packet. Okay, there it is. I'm happy to make that motion if you'll entertain it.
Go right ahead, Steve.
So the first motion is a motion to recommend approval of the required findings in Attachment A, including a finding of no significant effect for the adoption of amendments to the TRPA Code of Ordinances related to 1, bonus unit boundary, including amendments to Chapter 52, 2, non-conforming density, including amendments to Chapter 31, 3, accessory dwelling units, including amendment to Chapters 21, 31, 39, 50, 51, 52, and 90, Myers, Tahoe Valley, and Tahoe Tourist Corps area plans, and rules of procedure, section 12, number 4, development rights, strategic initiative, code cleanup, potential residential units of use, and bonus unit pools, including amendments to chapters 51 and 52, as shown in attachment B.
Thank you very much, Steve. Do I have a second?
Second, Eric Young.
Thank you, Eric. All right, we have a motion and a second. Is there any additional discussion from the committee? All right, hearing none. Tracy, if you would please provide us with a roll call vote.
Ms. Chandler?
Yes, please.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Mr. Booth?
Yes.
Ms. Roverud?
Yes.
Mr. Oling?
Aye.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Ms. Ferris?
Yes.
Mr. Hill? Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Ms. Stella? Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Ms. Stella?
Sorry, I missed it the first time. I couldn't find my mute button. I'm a yes.
Thank you. And Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Madam Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to continue making the motions that are in the packet, or I'm happy to share wealth with motion making with my colleagues.
Please let the record reflect Eric Gabon is a yes.
Thank you, Eric.
Welcome, Eric. Thank you.
Please let the record reflect that Ben Letton is a yes as well.
Oh, God. Apologies.
So I'll, to move things along, I'll make the second motion, Madam Chair, if that's acceptable.
Go right ahead, Steve.
A motion to recommend approval and adoption of ordinance number to be named later, attachment C, amending ordinance 87-9 as amended for the adoption of amendments to the TRPA Code of Ordinances, chapters 21, 31, 39, 50, 51, 52, and 90.
Thank you. I have a motion. Do we have a second?
This is Susan. I will second it.
Take a second from Susan Chandler. All right. Any other discussion on the motion? All right. Tracy, back to you.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Ms. Roverud?
Yes.
Mr. Lesson?
Yes.
Ms. Stala?
Yes.
Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill? Ms. Ferris?
Yes.
Mr. Gavan?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Ms. Chandler?
Yes.
Mr. Oling?
Aye.
Mr. Booth?
Yes.
And Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Madam Chair, that motion also passes.
I'm happy to make the motion on the next item.
Thank you, Steve.
Just double checking. Did we get Ben Letton on that last one? I wasn't checking off.
Yes, we did.
Okay, thank you. All right. Go ahead, Steve.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a motion to adopt resolution number 21 to be named later, to amend the rules of procedure as set forth in attachment D.
Right, we have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second this. Crystal Jacobson.
Thank you, Crystal. All right, any discussion on the motion?
Oh, excuse me.
Sorry. All right, go ahead.
Mr. Oling?
Aye.
Mr. Booth?
Aye.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Ms. Chandler?
Yes.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Mr. Letton?
Yes.
Ms. Roverud?
Yes.
Ms. Ferris?
Yes.
Mr. Gavon?
Yes.
Mr. Simon? Oh, sorry, Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Mr. Hill? Ms. Stala?
Yes.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Ms. Carr?
Yes.
The motion passes.
Thank you. All right, we have a fourth motion to make.
I'll be happy to make that while Hillary develops number five.
Go ahead, Steve. Okay.
This is a motion to recommend approval and adoption of amendments to the Myers Area Plan, Tahoe Valley Area Plan, and Tourist Corps Area Plan, as shown in Attachment B, separate adopting ordinances for which will be presented for the Governing Board after the local jurisdictions have taken action on the changes.
I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second, Eric Young.
Thank you, Eric. All right. Any discussion on the motion? All right. Let's do the roll call again. Thank you.
Ms. Roverud?
Yes.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Letton?
Yes.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Ms. Stala?
Yes.
Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Mr. Hill? Ms. Ferris?
Yes.
Mr. Gavon?
Yes.
Ms. Chandler?
Yes.
Mr. Booth?
Yes.
Mr. Orling?
Aye.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Ms. Carr?
Yes. Thank you.
Madam Chair, that motion passes.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. All right, and we won't have a slide for it, but Ms. Roverud, if you would like to make a fifth motion for us today, you have the floor.
All right, thank you. Winging it here a little, so other APC members or TRPA staff, if you have any suggestions on different wording, please speak up. I'd like to make a motion to recommend that the Tahoe Living Housing Community Revitalization Working Group work plan continue to prioritize discussion and evaluation of the development rights required for developing an ADU.
Thank you very much, Hillary. Do we have a second to the motion?
Second.
Second, Eric Young.
Go ahead, Eric. Take care.
Wonderful. Thank you. All right, any discussion on the motion? All right, we'll do another roll call vote. Thank you very much, staff. Go ahead, Tracy.
Ms. Simon?
Yes.
Ms. Stala?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Ms. Chandler?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Mr. Orling?
Aye.
Mr. Drew? Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Mr. Letton?
Yes.
Ms. Roverud?
Yes.
Mr. Hill? Ms. Ferris?
Yes.
Mr. Gavon?
Yes.
Mr. Booth?
Yes.
And Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Madam Chair, that motion passes.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone, and particular thanks for everyone of this meeting and the last meeting for engaging so well in this discussion. And thank you, Hillary, for continuing to promote the priorities and focus on this issue moving forward. I'd also like to thank the public for participating today and providing comment to us both in advance and at the meeting. It's been very helpful. So we're now on to agenda item number 6, which is planning matters. Item 6A is an aquatic invasive species annual program update, and Dennis Zabaglo is going to be presenting on a packet that you, item that you can find on page 151 of your packet. So go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Dennis Zabaglo with the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. I think you should be seeing my screen.
Yes, we are. Thank you.
Okay, great. So today we'll just give an update on the AIS program. I'm the Aquatic Resources Program Manager for the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, and I oversee the implementation of our program for the basin. So today we'll just do a brief introduction and update on the program in case we have some new members, and it's been a while to some degree. We'll talk about the partnerships that we have, and the success that those partnerships have brought us, and then some of the challenges and what's led to some really great opportunities as we've learned from or have some lessons learned. We'll go over the prevention program, some of the new features we have in our program this year, and we'll talk about the number of mussel boats we've seen this summer already. We'll talk about our control program and our aquatic invasive species control action agenda, which is our strategic plan for control. We'll go over some of the major projects we're undertaking at the moment. I'll do a brief update on the Tahoe Keys, as we'll be coming back to you later in the year. And then we'll end with an update on the funding for the program. So as you likely know, the program is, the aquatic invasive species program is one of the priority programs of the Environmental Improvement Program. We have our management plan that's been approved by both governors and the executive director of the TRPA, and approved by the Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force, which is the federal advisory committee that oversees aquatic invasive species issues nationally. And so that plan designates TRPA as the lead for implementing the plan and overseeing and being the fiscal agent for the program in the basin. And it deals with prevention, control, monitoring, and embedded in everything we do is education, as that's extremely critical. But the program has had all the success because of the partnerships that we've had. Private-public partnerships continue to be the hallmark of many programs within the agency, but certainly the Aquatic Invasive Species Program, with dozens and dozens of private and public partners, not only our implementing partners, such as the Tahoe Resource Conservation District, but also other implementing partners and agencies around the basin, but also the marinas and the launch ramps, all the local facilities, private facilities that help us implement the prevention program, and of course the boaters. Without all of their support, this program would not be anywhere near as successful as it is. And some of the challenges that we've experienced, 2020 was a bit crazy, but we did learn a lot of things. And one thing is that the boaters do appreciate additional services. And I'll be talking about some of these things in more detail as we go through the presentation. But the way we've implemented the program this year, with the ability to make appointments, and then, while not necessarily a lesson learned, but certainly reinforced after last year during COVID, that communication with our partnerships is critical. Just having that ability to pick up the phone and brainstorm or strategize or problem solve at a moment's notice is really helpful for us to ensure the program success, and then just deal with issues that just pop up on a regular basis. And so another thing I'll be talking about also is that we've learned new ways to implement control techniques that we've been implementing for several years, and I'll talk about that in a moment. So the prevention program, it works because it's mandatory. We have rigorous training of all of our inspectors, but also the marina staff to ensure that only inspected boats are being launched, and we designate that inspection with the use of a security seal that sits between the boat and the trailer. And so if that seal is not present, then the boat cannot launch. And then all our protocols are not only vetted through our partnerships regionally at the Western level, TRPA's program or the Tahoe program is considered really the gold standard for the rest of the country because of what we've been able to accomplish, not only from a protocols based on science, but the customer service that we employ as well. And then certainly education, as I mentioned, critical to everything we're doing in this program. The clean, drain, and dry mantra is what we promote regularly, not only at our stations, in our pamphlets and brochures, and on our website. And what's great about the clean, drain, and dry message, it's action-oriented. It's simple, but so we explain on the website like what it's for, or why it's important, but we also tell you how to accomplish it. So there's videos online showing you how to accomplish a clean, drain, and dry. So when you come to the inspection station, your process is already mostly complete and much more simple and reducing risk to the rest of the lake. So some of the new features I mentioned, we did implement a appointment system this year. Here's an example of how you do that online. And what's really exciting is that more than half of our inspections that we've conducted to date have been through the appointment system. I wasn't expecting to have that level of use. I was thinking more of 25% perhaps, but having close to 60% of our boaters choosing to use the appointment system, I think just speaks volumes as to the service that people expect and want. And the fact that we're charging a convenience fee on top of that to have that extra level of service similar to Southwest's early bird check-in, if you will, it's creating additional revenues to ensure that we have the best staff, the best trained staff, and being competitive with salaries. And then we have a new feature at the Meyer Station this year with support from the Tahoe Fund. We have an educational gazebo where users can learn about the program and other environmental issues important to Lake Tahoe while they're getting their boat inspected. So it's a cool feature that's getting quite a bit of use. Here's just another example of some of the educational items that are included in the gazebo with great help from the TRPA staff, Tahoe Fund, and the League to Save Lake Tahoe to making sure we have great information and it looks good too. So you may have seen in various press releases or in the news, the number of mussel boats we've seen this year is pretty significant. We've had 24 so far this year. We had 21 all of last year. We're seeing a lot of new boaters come to Tahoe. We're seeing local boaters buying boats new to them from other areas. But that's something we're prepared for. The training that I mentioned, it's rigorous. We go through it every year. We refresh the inspectors with training. We do a secret shopper program to make sure our protocols are being followed, not only at the inspection station, but at the ramps and marinas. And we have regional collaboration on this issue because we're not unique to this challenge that we're experiencing this year. It's happening throughout the West, and we're working with our Western partners to get the word out to various transport companies that haul boats from points east to areas that are free from mussels, looking to do joint advertisements in boat selling publications like Boat Trader. And then we've had a pretty significant discussion at the national level with the Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force that I mentioned. TRPA serves on that body, but I am also serving as chair of the Western Regional Panel, which is the entity that coordinates all the Western programs. And that organization has a seat at that table as well. And so ensuring that we have clear communication with the headquarters of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on this issue, looking at other aspects to do roadside alerts, similar to some of the alerts truckers get with way stations, but also some of the AM radio messaging for national parks, looking to see how we can implement something like that as well. And then, as I mentioned, working with the transport companies to ensure that they know these boats need to be inspected before they go straight to a marina. But we're also locally doing quite a bit of outreach on this issue. So not only we're taking every opportunity to ensure that boaters know that the prevention program is important and why you need to ensure when you're buying a boat that you do your due diligence and investigate where it's from, what it looks like, have somebody inspect it for you if you're buying it from another location. But we have the gazebo, as I mentioned, but we also have billboards. This example here is on Highway 50 coming in from Sacramento. We also have one on Highway 80, and then various rat cards and brochures and print publications. And then not only are press releases getting quite a bit of spread, but the news stations are picking up on the issue as well. And so we're taking that opportunity to do the newscasts with the local reporters. And as you can see here, we've had quite a bit of outreach on this issue. So shifting into our control program, implementation of projects throughout the basin for the existing species, such as Eurasian water milfoil and curly-leaf pondweed. Here's some examples of the techniques we use. On the bottom left is Sand Harbor, where we finished up a control project for Asian clams last year. Those are bottom barriers that suffocate the clams. We achieved about an 80% mortality rate in that area, although it was much larger than we anticipated. We knocked back that population several generations in order to reduce the number of clams in that area. But bottom barriers are also used to control invasive weed species a little bit differently, but similar. They're gas permeable, so they allow oxygen in the water to move freely through it, but basically it's blocking photosynthesis, so it's stopping that process and killing those plants. And in the middle picture there is some diver assisted suction, where they're removing not only the plant itself, but the root structure and some of the turions that are embedded into the substrate. And the turions are basically a seed-like structure for curly-leaf pondweed that allows them to reproduce. But then also innovation is a big aspect of our program. We're doing using techniques here that is not being implemented anywhere else in the country. And the picture here is the UV light boat. That's the new boat that's been constructed that was launched at Lakeside Marina on the South Shore close to State Line, doing some work there. And now that boat is over at the Tahoe Keys, and I'll talk about that momentarily. So I mentioned our AIS control action agenda. This is the strategic plan that was put into place in the early part of last year and developed with coordination from the California Tahoe Conservancy and the rest of our Aquatic Species Coordinating Committee, all the agencies and public entities in the basin, looking at all of our active sites or all of the sites we've known to have some level of infestation of existing species, and every site that we're aware of based on the intensive monitoring that we did at the end of 2018, every site is being addressed to some degree, whether it's in a planning phase or active implementation or in a post-project surveillance mode. So that's pretty exciting that we have every location that we're aware of under some level of activity. And one thing we're working on now with our agency partners is to redevelop some of our performance metrics. Right now we use acres treated, which is really good for us from a level of effort perspective, but what the control action agenda seeks to do is reduce our existing plant populations by 90% over a 10-year planning horizon. So we've got a little bit of a head start on that. And so we need to have some other metrics that will allow us to track that success. So acres reduced or number of projects being implemented to ensure that we're being able to track the success of achieving that 90% reduction. Some of the major projects that are underway, Meeks Bay on the bottom left there. And what's exciting about projects like Meeks Bay and another one I'll talk about momentarily is that these are the beginning phases of an overall restoration project. So we're dealing with mainly Eurasian water milfoil in Meeks Bay. That project should be wrapping up this year, which is exciting. But what the next step is to do an overall restoration of that area. So having these complementary restoration projects is really cool to have to restore these sensitive areas. And then at Ski Run is one of our challenging locations where right now we're investigating another innovative technique called laminar flow aeration. There's an example there of one of the diffusers that emits millions of tiny little bubbles that create this continuous level of oxygen, not only from the surface, but all the way down to the substrate that helps decompose some of the inorganic or loose organic materials at the bottom, also known as muck, but that's some of the where a lot of the nutrients are that the plants feed on. So looking at ways to reduce that. And so we're having some level of success there at Ski Run, but it's not 100%. Just like any of our projects, one technique alone is not going to do the trick. So we're now looking at ways to complement that laminar flow aeration to ensure we have a successful project, a successful outcome with that project in the future. And again, another innovative approach only being used here in Tahoe with bubble curtains to prevent the spread of fragments from areas of infestation to areas of non-infestation. The first one was put in place in the west channel of the Tahoe Keys with support from the property owners and the League Disabled Lake Tahoe. But now TRPA, the League, the Tahoe Fund, and homeowners at the TKPOA and at Elk Point Marina, which is on the east shore, new bubble curtains to not in the Keys to help prevent the spread of those fragments from going into the lake from inside the Keys. But at Elk Point, we're looking to stop fragments that have spread from other areas into their marina. Some active control projects are going on in there to reduce weed populations, and so protecting that investment, if you will, from being reinfested. Here's an example of how the bubble curtain works. It's just some hose airlines that emit lots of bubbles in a wall formation that block the fragments. It's amazing how effective it can be. It's not 100% like anything, but it's giving us a much better ability to control their spread, a best management practice, if you will. And so here's an example of a plant fragment being kind of held in place, if you will, by this bubble curtain. And Lakeside Marina actually has also implemented one. That's an area where we've done a lot of work, not only with bottom barriers and divers, but with UV light as well. And so their marina has just put one in place as well to help protect that control project. So the biggest project we have going on this summer is the Taylor Tillac project. This is another example of the AIS control portion being phase one of an overall restoration. This project is going to become the hallmark of our success stories, if you will. Emerald Bay for years was the one we always pointed to because of what we learned in that location, that we have to have multiple techniques. We have to implement these projects over the course of multiple seasons. At 6 acres, that was highly successful. Now we're touting that area as locally eradicated. So it's very exciting. If you've seen pictures in the past of the before and after, it's pretty remarkable. But here at Taylor Tillac, this is over 17 acres of an infestation of mainly Eurasian water milfoil in the Taylor and Tillac creeks and wetland areas, marsh areas. Looking to implement that project this August. We're finalizing some of the permitting with Lahontan and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and mainly doing bottom barriers at this location. This location is also extremely important because it is the last active fully functioning wetland in the basin. So ensuring that we do restoration in that area is extremely important. It was surprising to hear we had a pretty successful executive field trip, if you will, with leadership from TRPA, Lahontan, and the Forest Service, coordinating to ensure that we're all on the same page and recognizing the importance of this program and that we're working together to get it implemented as quickly as we can. And learning that it is the last native functioning wetland in the basin, but also that it has the ability to have habitat for every native species in the basin. So a pretty important project, and we're excited to get that project underway next month. Just another example of how big it is and the difficulty of this project. Certainly will be an expensive project, but we're getting good funding from TRPA and the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act, and also Lake Tahoe Restoration Act funds from the Forest Service. And we were just awarded $100,000 from the Tahoe Fund. So we're very grateful that we're getting these private contributions as well. Right now, the price tag of this project is just over $3.5 million. But with the funding we have in place and the ability to do implementation of existing techniques, but a new way, as I mentioned when we started. That top picture is an example of bottom barriers being used. They're about 10 feet by 40 feet in dimension, but there's significant overlap that's required to ensure that we have proper coverage. And so we lose about 30% of coverage of those bottom barriers because of the overlap that we have to implement. And so now we're buying these bottom barriers in these giant Saran wrap rolls, if you will, that can be unrolled much more efficiently by divers. So we're saving money on labor, but also saving quite a bit on that overlap issue. And so being able to use these bottom barriers in this new fashion, we're saving about $1 million on what this project would have cost. So it's exciting as well. So another major project that we're actively working on. It started last year. It's an area we call the Tahoe Keys Complex. This is the area immediately outside of the boating channels at the Tahoe Keys. It's about a 100-acre infestation, but at varying levels of density. So it's not all densely populated with invasive plant, aquatic plant species. But we started some diver-assisted suction last year, and that work is ongoing into this year. And so last year we were working in the homeowner channel on the west side. This year we're doing work on the eastern portion. You can see on the left picture there, those areas outlined in red are some of the areas we're focusing on. So another big project that's important. It's a little bit different than other projects we've implemented in the past, where all of our projects are essentially looking to locally eradicate those species from those areas. But in this case, because it's so big and we know we have the infestation within the Keys itself, this is a effort to keep that infestation at bay, if you will, to keep it from getting way out of hand, so where it would become unmanageable. So we're having good success with also additional funds coming from the SB 630 program, the League to Save Lake Tahoe, and of course TRPA funds going towards the implementation with the Tahoe Resource Conservation District leading that effort. This area is also a little bit more challenging because of the high boat activity, so we're spending additional time to ensure that we have outreach with our partners within that area, specifically rental companies and the marina. Because of the activity, we want to ensure that we have good we're being able to keep our divers safe. And so that's just another challenge that we're dealing with, and having a good success and building new partnerships with some of those entities. Here's just an example of some of the work that they're doing, mainly diver-assisted suction. There is quite a bit of curly-leaf pondweed out there, so we want to use a technique that we know that can remove the plants, but also remove those turions, as I mentioned. And this is an example of the work that was of the location where the work started last year and what it looked like at the start of this year. So we're pretty happy about the outcome of that area. So the Tahoe Keys control methods test, this is the collaborative effort addressing the largest infestation of aquatic invasive plants that we have within the Tahoe Keys. It's a challenging project, not only because of the size and scale, at over 170 acres, entirely infested with Eurasian water milfoil and curly-leaf pondweed. It's complicated because of not only because of that, but the varying conditions within the Keys. Using our tried and true methods is difficult at best in this location. And so the property owners have proposed the use of aquatic herbicides. And so while controversial for many reasons, it's never been done in a water, they've never been used in a water body like Lake Tahoe. And so when we recognize that what was being proposed, we knew it was going to be complicated. And so we took the initiative to create a stakeholder committee to develop collaborative approaches to dealing with this infestation. And so we have not only TRP and Lahontan, but the homeowners, the League to Save Lake Tahoe, the Tahoe Water Tahoe Drinking Water Suppliers Association, and the Tahoe Resource Conservation District. Just ensuring a transparent process and that all ideas of how to deal with this infestation are being addressed. And so what has resulted from that is the test approach, looking at multiple methods, not only with the proposed use of aquatic herbicides, but complementing that with some of the innovative approaches that I mentioned with UV light, but then also being able to follow up with the traditional methods. And so we're in the process now. We released the draft of the environmental documents last summer, and what's being worked on now is some of the monitoring plans, but also the draft permits and the anti-degradation analysis that will be available shortly for not only agency review, but public review with those draft permits. So that's on the next steps, but then also having the Tahoe Science Advisory Council do a peer review of some elements of those, of that monitoring plan. And what we've learned so far is that with careful planning and monitoring and protection measures put in place and with the proposed mitigations, that all of the potential impacts that have been identified are less than significant. And so, as I said, we'll be coming back to the Advisory Planning Commission later this year as we're able to release the draft permits and the anti-degradation analysis, as I mentioned, but also as we approach the release of the final environmental documents. And so the agencies have committed that the final documents will be presented to our boards, the TRPA board, as well as the Lahontan board, in January of 2022 for certification and approval of work. So while that process is continuing, we are taking every opportunity to use what the public had suggested during the public comment period to implement additional tests as the process continues. And so we're doing just that. I mentioned the UV light work that has been ongoing in the Lakeside Marina for the last couple years. We're now increasing the ability of that or the use of that technique by over 400%, looking at treating 8 acres with UV light, where in the past we've only done 2 1-acre locations. And so within the Keys, we have 3 areas, one associated with the Tahoe Keys complex work in the boating channel, as you see in the upper left portion of that right-hand picture, but then the 2 red areas below within the channels themselves. Those are 2 canals or fingers within the Tahoe Keys that represent about 2 acres each. The work started a week ago today in that upper finger, which is what we refer to as Site 24, with work going on there for about 2 weeks, and then moving to that second finger, and then having 2 treatment rounds this summer to continue to implement this emerging technology. And what we've learned over the last couple of years, not only in the Lakeside location, but the experimentation we did with this technique last year, because of some of those conditions I mentioned and the keys that are varying, one of the challenges we're experiencing is it's not a flat bottom in locations like we've implemented this technique at Lakeside. These channels are more U-shaped, if you will, or angled in some respects. And so the developer of the technology, Inventive Resources Incorporated, has built the light array so it can be articulated. Not only can it move and be rotated so it can go under boats and under structures, but it can also be angled so it can address and treat more efficiently the angled bottom. So you can see an example of how the UV light array can be used in that way. And as I said, the work started there last week, so we're really excited to have additional opportunities to use this new technique. And another picture of that boat that was put in place. And so he's also added these little foam poles, if you will, that alert boaters that are in that area that work is being done and not to drive over the UV light array. And so just all the different things that we've learned and being able to implement those to ensure we have successful use of this technique. Another thing that was learned also, because of the water quality conditions and the keys are a little bit different than the rest of the lake, the bulbs of this UV light array need to be changed on a more regular basis. And so he made that process easier. Instead of having to take the boat out of the water to do that, he can now do that while the boat still sits in the water, because it's pretty large and taking it in and out of the water is time consuming. So ending with program funding, we have various funding sources, not only from the two states that help provide funding for the prevention program, but we have the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act that we're very excited has increased over time the amount of funding we get from that grant opportunity through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which started out at $3 million per year, but now we're at $4 million per year. So having that coordination and continued communication with our delegation to ensure that the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act is appropriated on a regular basis through the federal budget is really critical. And so Julie and her team, working with our Senate delegation, our House delegation, which is really great because we've had both sides of the aisle support this program and support increases in funding for that. And so what we're looking at for the long term with some additional funds we're getting from the license plate grant through the Nevada Division of State Lands, the license plate grant, is we are looking at implementing constructing a permanent inspection station on the Nevada side near where we are now at Spooner Summit, a little bit further up Highway 28, which is part of the Highway 28 Corridor Management Plan. We have funding from that license plate grant, as I mentioned, to develop design plans for the inspection station, and an RFP for that design should be going out shortly in cooperation with the Tahoe Transportation District. And other funding aspects that we're continuing to ensure we're being able to have that staff retention. The staff we have is incredible, and we want to make sure we keep them and have the ability to have trained, dedicated staff on a regular basis. And so ensuring we're competitive is important and something we address every year with not only our fees, but the inspectors, the training, as I mentioned, and just other opportunities for them to perform in other aspects of the program, helping with monitoring out in the lake. We do routine sampling to ensure that no new AIS have been found, which is something we're very proud of since 2008, since the program began. No new invasions have occurred, so that's very exciting. You've heard me say it many times, but it's something we're really proud of and is not really experienced in a lot of places. So it's something we should all be proud of because we have great support, not only from the Advisory Planning Commission, but our governing board and as from our partners as well, as I mentioned. And then the control, the action agenda, as I mentioned, ensuring we have funding to continue to implement these projects, that 10-year planning horizon with a 90% reduction goal has a about a $75 million price tag. And so we're about halfway there. If you look at it on a yearly basis of $7.5 million a year, with the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act at $4 million, we're halfway there, and we have funding support from our partners, as I mentioned, with the SB 630 program, but also other federal grants that we're able to get along with state funds as well. So we are very excited about the what's in front of us. We know it's ambitious, but you've probably heard that the reauthorization of the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act was just introduced. And so being able to extend the funding opportunity through that act, we're optimistic that we'll be continuing to have funding come in to support the program. So if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them, but just wanted to thank all of our partners for the hard work. We have a great team assembled, not only at TRPA, but with our partners, and we have a plan to build on our success. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dennis. That's all really great information, and sound like there were some new things since the last time I saw a presentation on this. So thanks for those updates. Particularly pleased to see like the appointments, the appointments for doing boat inspections, the secret shoppers. And I really think the structure, the educational structure at Myers is brilliant, because you provide, especially this year where it's just so darn hot, you've attracted them with shade and a place to sit. And while they're there, you get to educate them. So I think that's fantastic. I'm also excited about the other control projects that we're seeing people initiate, not just through, you know, TRPA's efforts, but private partnerships and the folks that are expanding this technology into other areas of their own volition. I think that's fantastic. I do have one question about the potential partnership or any discussions that might be going on between your program and the folks that are doing the trash cleanup, because they're crawling over every mile of the lake. So are they educated and aware of AIS species and able to alert you if they find something that you don't know about?
Yeah, that's a great question. We haven't had that ability to engage with them so far this season, but in the past, we've certainly worked with them. And Jeff Cowan on our team is engaged with those diver groups. We'll ensure that we have information that we can share with them to ensure that they're aware of the existing species and if they see anything new. And then certainly with the citizen science program led by the league, with the Eyes on the Lake, if there's ways to incorporate those efforts as well, we'll make sure that happens.
Great, wonderful. So other questions or comments from APC members?
Yes, this is Susan. I'd like to just take a minute to thank Dennis and all of the stakeholders. I've been on the water quality committee at the Tahoe Keys for the last 4 years. And finally, we're starting to see that with all of the cooperation that we're getting from outside organizations, that we are beginning to see a light at the end of the tunnel. We're very excited about the possibility of being permitted by January of 2022, and we think things are starting to move in a positive direction. So thank you for everything that you're doing to move this project forward. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Susan. The cooperation with the Water Quality Committee and the rest of the property owners has been phenomenal, and we wouldn't be in a position where we are now, having documented ready to be released in the final version. It's exciting to see how much progress we have made on such a challenging issue. So thank you.
Yeah, this is Judy Simon. I would like to say that I've been following that issue of the invasive species in the Tahoe Keys for some time, and I'm very encouraged by your report. Excuse me, and hope that we can continue to work on this. And I'll talk to you offline, but I'd really like to visit the project at some point.
We can do that. It's one thing for me to talk about it, but to see it firsthand is really eye-opening.
I've looked at several reports through the years, but it would be really wonderful for me to do that visit. Thank you.
All right, other APC members?
Good work, Dennis.
Thank you.
Wonderful. All right, so hearing that, no other comments for the moment, we will now move to public comment on this item. If you joined us just for this item and hadn't heard this before, to participate in the meeting, go to trpa.gov in the calendar, click on Advisory Planning Commission, July 14th, 2021, and there you will find a link to the public webinar hosted on GoToWebinar. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission, please use the hand-raising function now, and you will be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. So go ahead and open up for public comment, please.
Madam Chair, we have no hands raised to comment on this item.
All right. We will close public comment. Any other further questions or input from APC?
I just would have one question. This is Susan. I'm wondering when the APC will be bringing this topic up again.
As far as the Tahoe Keys control methods test, we would be likely coming back closer to the end of the year when the final document is being released.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. All right, that was an informational only item. So we will move on now to agenda item 7, which is reports. John Hester, do you have your executive director report and upcoming topics to share with us today?
Yes, I do, Madam Chairman. As the Chair Ferry asked last month, he asked for a report on items that you've heard before and what happened to them. So one of them was the Tahoe Living Working Group housing items, which that was an information presentation. And as Karen mentioned, she took it to a couple other places along the way and then came back to you for recommendation. So you all know what you did there, and it will be going to the Regional Plan Implementation Committee and the Governing Board later this month. The other item that you covered last month was the threshold evaluation issuance. You recommended that the Governing Board do that, and they did, in fact, do what you recommended. And then upcoming topics, just thought I would let you know that next month's meeting will be canceled. So enjoy the extra few hours. And that's all I have to report.
Thank you, John. The cancellation, I presume, is due to the Tahoe Summit. And so folks that are interested in that public event, I believe it's going to be part in person, a very limited amount of attendance in person and virtual, much like it was last year. So it's an interesting event if you follow the summit activities. Ms. Marsha Birch, do you have any updates for General Counsel?
Hello, all, and I apologize for my technical problems earlier. I had to restart my internet. I do not have any updates, and I spoke briefly with John, and he didn't have anything for me to pass on.
Thank you. All right, I will... just to keep things moving fairly smoothly, I will go through my list and ask for any reports from APC members. So we'll start with Ellery.
Hi, everyone. I have no items to report this month. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellery. Hillary.
Nothing to report. Thank you.
Thank you. Susan Chandler?
Nothing to report. Thank you.
All right. Well, Crystal Jacobson?
Yeah, just one item. Our board is going to meet up in Tahoe on July 27th, and we're taking a few different housing-related items to the board on that day, so still trying to kind of continue to move the needle on addressing housing needs in the region. That's it for me.
Thank you, Crystal. Judy Simon?
No specific report, but only to say that Washoe County is had instituted some short-term rental regulations, and we're looking at those in relationship to the ADU items that we discussed today.
Thank you. Ben Letton.
Nothing to report, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Young?
Nothing to report. Thank you. Nice to see everybody.
Yeah, it's nice to have more cameras on now. Sam Booth?
Nothing to report at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Drake?
Nothing to report, but thanks, Hillary, for putting together that final motion. I think that's an important item to move forward.
Thanks, Kevin. Eric Givon.
We've been pretty busy at the fire district. We had obviously 4th of July stuff going on. A lot of questions about, you know, how we were able to do fireworks. They were smaller shows, safer shows, clean shows. And it went off really well. If you had any concerns or anything, if you'd want to contact me directly, that'd be great. I know the public had some questions. We're going into a pretty heavy fire season, or we're in one. So that's a concern for us as well going forward. And just got a lot of things going on. The golf tournament just finished up, as you know, and we finished the you know, working on getting that event center out of the ground. So a lot going on with the fire district and within our area and around the basin.
Thank you, Eric. And finally, Steve.
Thank you, Madam Chair. During his presentation today, Mr. Zavaglo mentioned the Lake Tahoe Restoration Act reauthorization bill. It's a very important bill. Extends the $415 million authorization through September 30th of 2034. And there was a hearing on that bill yesterday at the subcommittee in the House on National Parks, Forests, and Public Lands. Excuse me, that the House version of that bill is H.R. 132. There's also a companion Senate version of the bill. There was a hearing, which is an important part of the process moving forward, the next time the bill will be considered for advancement in the House process. So another important step forward yesterday. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that update, Steve. Did I miss anyone? We had a couple folks leave early. So. All right. So with that, we are on agenda item 8, closing public interest comments. Members of the public participating in our virtual meeting via the GoToWebinar app on their computer, smartphone, or tablet should raise their hand now to indicate that they wish to speak and can be unmuted by TRPA staff. Are there any hands raised for us in the final public comment today?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are no hands raised to comment on this item.
All right, so again, I'll note for your calendars that, as John Hester mentioned, the August meeting will be canceled. And so I will take a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All right, I'll second that. All in favor?
Aye.
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 All right, the July meeting of the APC is adjourned at 11:35 a.m. Thank you all for your time this morning and your active participation, as I said before, in our meeting today and the topics. So.
Thank you.